This is Stephen Clark, a research analyst at the Gartam Institute, and I'm here talking today to Andrew Palmer, business affairs editor of The Economist, about his new book, Smart Money. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
So the subtitle of your book is How High-Stakes Financial Innovation is Reshaping Our World for the Better. Some might say that the image of high-stakes finance has been tarnished by the recent crash. How has it made our world a better place?
It is clear that the image of finance and financial innovation has been badly hit by the crisis. And I should make clear that the book is not a full-throated apology for everything that the banks and its most creative members did in the run-up to the crisis. But the contention of the book is that finance has, from time immemorial, helped humans to solve big economic problems. It's helped to create money when we needed means of exchange, it's invented debt when we wanted to invest, it's invented insurance when we wanted to mitigate risk. And there are still an enormous number of very big problems out there that require finance to innovate and to help solve. So if we think about, you know, the problem of an aging society, for example, the pension is itself a financial instrument, clearly, but ways in which you can encourage people to save, encourage them to manage their finances better, both in the sort of accumulation phase, but also the decumulation phase. All of those are things where finance can make a material difference. And that narrative, I think, has been obscured by the crisis, and that's part of the point of writing the book.
You mentioned some problems there that the finance is able to overcome or at least partially solve. Or maybe wholly solve. But you describe housing or property as the most dangerous asset in the world, which suggests that could be a problem. I think the recent crisis just so. A great stat from the book is that mortgage debt in the United States doubled between 2001 and 2007. Can you explain maybe how financial innovation can address this problem?
Yeah, so we think of property as having attracted too much innovation. And clearly people thought up products which were basically designed to blow up after a certain period of time. But all the innovation was on the debt side. There wasn't innovation on the equity side. There wasn't a way of enabling people to share the risk of house price falls with lenders, which is the what a shared equity mortgage is designed to do. Now, these products are very hard to get off the ground in an environment where regulators and politicians do nothing but dangle goodies in front of would-be homeowners. But they are a product that basically says, you know, if house prices go up, then your bank will share in the gains. But if they go down, they will also share in the downside. And that means there is much more flexibility in terms of an individual's ability to respond to house price crashes. What we saw in the crisis was that when house prices went down, everyone wanted to stay in their homes, with a few exceptions, and therefore they cut their spending. And at the macro level, there was a big economic shock. Equity mortgages, shared equity mortgages, basically enable a bit more flexibility, a bit more of a cushion in the way that people can respond. That's a really interesting innovation that's being played with. Another is using securitization, which is a technique that many people sort of think of as being a way to blow things up, to help promote renting. So we're obsessed with the idea of home ownership in the Anglophone countries. But you can use securitization, which is a way of just smooshing together the income flows from lots of different assets and apply that to the rental sector. So you've got lots of different tenants in lots of different houses putting together their rental payments into a bond, which investors can then invest in. That's a way of funding the rental sector, and that in turn is a good way of weaning all of us off this addiction to the idea of home ownership as a great thing.
Very interesting. I thought those two products, when I read about them in your book, were fascinating and really demonstrated that finances are constantly kind of coming up with new products which can solve these problems. One of the interesting new products, if you like, that's come out in the last couple of years is Wonga in Britain, and has attracted a lot of negative media attention at times and political attention. One of the things I've always struck by Wonga is the kind of slick marketing and also the kind of technological approach they follow. Can you describe a bit more about how Wonga operates and why it, in some respects, could be a force for good?
So Wonga has a terrible reputation because it did some terrible things. It basically it went on the wrong side of the line in terms of appropriate and ethical behaviour in how it treated its customers. But what's interesting about Wonga is that it fills a gap in the market which is worsening after the crisis. And that gap is the ability of poorer people to access credit. The re-regulation of finance has meant that banks are way more incentivized to push their business towards wealthier individuals. Those are the people who will buy the mortgages and invest in the assets that provide fees and products with a big enough spread to make things viable. So you have a big section of society which is less likely to be able to access credit from the mainstream banks. So where do they go? So payday lenders is where they go. And that's a spectrum of activity that ranges from people with baseball bats to people who are trying to do a job of assessing creditworthiness beyond the very standard measures like credit scores and where do you live and what's your employment history. And that's where Wonga is interesting. So try and put aside the sort of the bad behavior and think about how Wonga is trying to use information beyond the sort of natural, just the constraints of a fairly blunt credit score. So thinking about a telephone record, social media activity, how people are filling out their applications, just scraping data from absolutely everywhere to build up a better picture of credit worthiness. And for the marginal borrower, that's basically the only way that they're going to be able to access credit in this new environment.
Yeah, I was really struck in the book by the comment or the passage which talks about how Wonga and other similar lenders looked at kind of how people wrote their names or how long they stayed on the terms and conditions. And I thought that was fascinating and showing, and it kind of links into another underlying theme, if I may, what I thought from the book was technology. So it seems that a lot of these new innovations are where kind of technology and finance meet. And I was wondering, you know, with technology having a maybe more positive image than maybe finance, how can technology kind of be involved with finance to solve some of the world's most intractable problems? And could you give me an example of maybe what you think one of the most intractable problems is and maybe how finance and technology are trying to solve it?
So technology is the most trusted industry in terms of public perceptions, and finance is the least trusted. So there's a really interesting polarization there. But the two are now meeting in a commercial way. So finance was sort of basically undisrupted by the arrival of the internet for years, and now the rise of fintech, financial technology firms, are bringing technology and finance together in really new, interesting and disruptive ways. So you have, for example, the rise of peer-to-peer lending platforms, also known as marketplace lenders, where you don't have a bank sitting in between a borrower and a lender. You basically just provide a marketplace and people can get together and funnel credit between each other as they desire. The problem that is solving is a very, very big one, which is A, getting credit to people who want it, capital to people who want it, and businesses too, but B, and this is the intractable one, diffusing some of the risks that dog finance as a whole. So banks blow up because they have too much leverage and because they are exposed to something called maturity transformation. People have a big mismatch between their assets and their liabilities. These platforms are ideally designed to address both problems. The risk of default doesn't sit with a bank, it sits with the end lender, and these assets and liabilities are matched. You put your money into the platform and you only get it back when the loan runs off. You don't get it back on demand like a deposit. So finance has sort of created this inherently fragile structure for very good reasons, but the fintech companies and these peer-to-peer platforms in particular are ways of sidestepping some of those inherent fragilities.
Oh, well, thank you very much for talking to us today. I found it a fascinating read and I think packed with many more examples like that. So thank you very much, Anna.
Thanks, Stephen. Thank you.